and the outrage that it has been met by at the climate summit and around the world.
Yeah, well, this is not the final text as yet, what we saw. It contained many options there, including a phase down of coal. It had references to fossil fuel phase out, and it had the production and consumption of fossil fuels reduced, and some other options. So it's not final as yet. It went to the heads of delegations and states last night, ministers last night. Many of us were following what was happening. The room was actually quite divided. And what was actually quite outrageous for us, if I may, the US, Canada, Australia, Japan, Germany, the European Union as a whole, one by one, stood up to say that the fossil fuel phase-out language is not there, or it was insufficient and needs to be strengthened, and that you need to keep the North Star. They kept repeating the North Star about keeping the 1.5 degree Celsius limit alive, and they kept referring to the North Star. Now, what was sickening to me was these are the so-called biggest polluters and emitters, historical emitters, who refuse to acknowledge historical responsibility, and they do not want to talk about the equitable distribution of the carbon budget from historical times, where developed countries and the rich countries have overconsumed 4/5 of that budget with very little space left for developing countries. So that was the call by the rich North, pretending to be climate champions, because we know and we have read the reports of many research organizations, including Oil Change International, which have clearly showed that these very same countries, as they come here and pretend to be climate champions and talk about limiting temperature rise and also talk about ending fossil fuels, have signed and continue to sign licenses for expansion and production of fossil fuels. So for us, it was absolutely duplicitous on their part to do that. And there was no reference to the means of implementation, which is the provision of finance, technology, and capacity building for developing countries to do the phase-out. So it was not about justice. It was not about climate justice. It was not about equity, because all they do here, and they come here and pretend as if it's all the fault of developing countries. So those of us who are here have been exposing this hypocrisy, and we are saying that the fossil fuel phase-out has to be fair, has to be just, has to be equitable, and developed countries must take the lead, and they must end fossil fuel production and consumption now, not in 2030, 2040, or 2050. And they have to do their fair shares of reductions, and they must take into account historical responsibility, and must provide the finance, the technology transfer for the developing countries to move into the transition. Because we can't do it overnight. They talk about peaking of emissions by 2025. That's a global peak. You can't have the rich world taking 100 over years to peak and preach to the developing world, much of whom do not have clean energy, do not have access to electricity, where there's constant breakdowns, even in New Delhi. People live in blackouts. And, of course, Tasneem will talk more about what happens in South Africa. So there is a need for a just transition, and it has to be, any outcome from here must be just and equitable. You can't just look at whether fossil fuel language is there, but the issue is really whether it can get done so that the poor don't have to be burdened even further. It cannot be applauded just because you have language on fossil fuels in the text.
So, Tasneem Essop, you're Executive Director of Climate Action Network. Is this really any surprise when you have the head of the UN Climate Summit, the head of the UAE's national oil company? He's an oil executive. who said before the copy even began that there's no science call behind a fossil fuel phase out. This seems to follow exactly what he has said. As people know, a few days ago, in Dubai, I followed him, asking him these two questions about being the head of the oil company and saying that there's no role for a fossil fuel phase out. And also the fact that at this UN climate summit, there are more fossil fuel lobbyists, close to 2,500, than, of course, at any COP before, something like four or three times more than there were in the last few years. Can you talk about the effects of that? Also, President Biden not showing up at this UN climate summit. Kamala Harris, the vice president, did. But what you're calling for, and also if you can talk about the protests that have and have not been allowed as you demand everything from fossil fuel phase out to a ceasefire in Gaza.
Yeah. Thanks, Amy. So I do want to be clear about the COP president's role in relation to the text and where negotiations are right now. Look, you know, he's made statements across the year since his appointment. I can say that we've been engaging the COP president, even though, you know, we've agreed to disagree on the issue of our priority to get an outcome for a just and equitable phase out of fossil fuels. He has been engaging NGOs, and so he's been pretty forthcoming in terms of the ideas that we're presenting to him, especially in relation to ensuring that equitable approach to a phase out of fossil fuels. That's an important element that MENA also speaks about. We can't just have phase out language as if there's no context to a phase out of fossil fuels. And so you would have seen that his rhetoric over the year did change. It shifted, you know, when the language of it is inevitable that we should have a phase out of fossil fuels. We heard that in Bonn already. He's been really, really wanting to get an outcome, recognizing that we have to have an outcome on fossil fuels at this COP. So, yes, of course, the context with, you know, fossil fuel industries being here, this is not a new phenomenon, Amy. We saw the starting, they've been in the process for many years, and the kind of visible presence already in Glasgow. These are all elements that we're not surprised about, but we need to be focused about the outcome, and he's not been at all in any active way appeared to be obstructive about that outcome in his engagement with us as NGOs. He was really keen to have an outcome on fossil phasing out fossil fuels as a legacy from COP28. So I just want to be clear about that and the engagements we've had with him. In relation to the protests, yes, certainly we came into this COP with a set of demands. One of them, of course, a just and equitable phase out of fossil fuels. The idea of a package, an energy package, is what we came into this COP with. And the package would include equitable phase out. It would include an equitable phasing of renewable energy. And importantly, and this is what's missing right now, financial support. The kind of transitions that developing countries will have to take, whether they are least developing countries, small island states, or middle income countries, that transition is going to cost money. And we know that our developing countries, particularly many of them reeling under debt burden, will need financial support. So when MENA talks about the challenges surrounding end of fossil fuels or a phase out, without understanding the context that we have to have an equitable phase out, and when developed countries do not understand that and will not commit to the levels of support required to achieve that equity, to lead, in fact, to lead, the text, the draft text on the table didn't make any reference to developed countries going first and fastest. And we know that reports, the IEA, IPCC said that there cannot be any new production, yet It is the developed countries that are still, as Mina says, signing licenses, expanding production, investing in fossil fuels. And so we have to address this. This is the real political context. We do want an outcome on a phase out of fossil fuels, but we do want it to be equitable and just. And this is where the developed countries will have to step up and do that and ensure that kind of outcome. The other issue that we've been protesting about, of course, is standing in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Palestine and highlighting the unfolding genocide in Gaza. Excuse me. So we have been very active in the space as well. It's been challenging, but we have been actively protesting on the genocide in Gaza.
I wanted to ask about a UN report finding global South countries need nearly $400 billion per year to prepare for climate change, but only $21 billion was given in 2021. The report saying, in addition to between $200 and $366 billion needed for every passing year, talk about the demands of the wealthy, you're making of wealthier nations and some of the worst polluters. For example, historically, the biggest one, the United States, now the largest polluter, China. If you can address these issues, and what impact does climate change have on your country in South Africa?
Well, we both are contributed to, climate change, but we're also extremely vulnerable to climate change. And we've had a number of extreme weather events recently, flooding, well, both in my city, Cape Town, in the Western Cape, and in KwaZulu-Natal. So, and there have been droughts in the country. So, of course, we are challenged and vulnerable. On the issue of finance, though, we're not talking about billions any longer, Amy. We're really needing to talk about the trillions. And this is where the conversation has to pivot towards. We're still hearing people talk about, you know, fulfilling a 100 billion obligation that they've not fulfilled yet. But we already understand that the accumulated needs now, whether we're addressing the actions we need to take to reduce emissions, whether it's the actions that we need to take to build resilience and for adaptation, and whether it's the funding needed to address loss and damage. When we look at that, we're really talking about trillions and not billions. And we have to look at all the measures to, get that resources, mostly for adaptation, loss and damage. It has to be public funding. It has to be. The developed countries right now are trying to, shift us away from taking a public funding approach to it and wanting to look at private sector funding, which is impossible. For, private sector will not fund loss and damage. They won't fund adaptation because it's not profit making. Certainly, maybe, for mitigation, yes, of course, but not for adaptation, not for loss and damage. And so certainly we're needing to talk about public funding. We need to talk about developed countries looking at securing that funding and mobilizing it. And then we have to also look at what we're calling the polluters pay principle, where we know the fossil fuel industry, those companies have to pay for their pollution. And they've been making huge profits. So certainly a windfall tax on fossil fuel companies is one of those options that we can look at. Yes, so for funding, and I'm sure Mina will be able to add to this, we developed countries have to step up. They can find funding so easily.
Mina, we just have a minute, Mina Raman. I wanted to end with you on what is going to happen today. Is this climate summit actually going to end? Are you going to succeed in getting concessions? And are you concerned that the loss and damage fund will be initially run by the World Bank?
Well, I think the loss and damage fund issue has already been settled. Unfortunately, developing countries had to have a, give a huge concession in allowing the World Bank to be the interim financial intermediary for 4 years, subject to conditions. So that battle has already been locked in. So we will be watching whether the World Bank lives up to its obligations. In relation to the outcome of the talks, we don't know as yet. We are waiting for the text, which will land on us in any time in the next few hours. And we expect the talks to go on late into the night, as always the case. And we really have to see whether this is a text which will actually help protect the planet and the poor, or will it continue to allow the biggest polluters and the big rich nations to continue to escape their responsibility, but pretend to be climate champions and continue fossil fuel expansion, production and consumption.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue this discussion tomorrow. Mina Raman is head of programs at Third World Network, president of Friends of the Earth Malaysia, and Tasneem Essop, executive director of Climate Action Network International from South Africa. Next up, the Texas Supreme Court has ruled against a woman who had to flee to another state to have an emergency abortion. And we'll look at how Kentucky's ban on abortion is being challenged. Stay with us.
Oh, my mind show the wind how you pass time.
A task you cannot hope to do, and I commiserate with you who made the parallel mistakes that add up to a grain. Praise, climb above the mountainside. Protest songs are in our eyes.
Of Womankind by Feist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Texas. After a week in legal limbo, Kate Cox, a woman who sought a court ruling to temporarily block Texas's abortion ban so she could get an emergency abortion, has left Texas to obtain the time-sensitive procedure she needs elsewhere. She's a mother of two who was 20 weeks pregnant when she sought the abortion after learning her fetus has a lethal abnormality and that being forced to carry the non-viable pregnancy to term could make it impossible for her to have more children. A Texas judge granted a court order last Thursday in the landmark case that would have allowed her to have the abortion. But the next day, the Texas Supreme Court temporarily overturned the order. And then on Monday, it issued a final ruling to stop Kate Cox from having an abortion. Texas Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton had filed the motion to overturn and threatened to prosecute any providers involved in giving Cox an abortion, from a doctor to a hospital. Cox spoke to NBC News last Thursday.
It's a hard time. We're going through the loss of a child. There's no outcome here that I take home my healthy baby girl, you know, so it's hard, you know. Just, grief.
The lawsuit filed by Kate Cox also sought protection for her husband and her doctor from the Texas law that allows anyone to sue patients, medical workers, a cab driver, or even a patient's family or friends who, quote, aid and abet an abortion. Meanwhile, pregnant woman in Kentucky is suing over her state's near-total ban on abortion. She's the lead plaintiff in the class action lawsuit, which argues the ban violates Kentucky's constitution. On Monday, her attorneys told a Kentucky court that after filing the case, the woman learned her embryo no longer has cardiac activity. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Kentucky, We're joined by Tamara Weider, Kentucky State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. And in Houston, Dr. Bhavik Kumar is with us, a family medical physician, abortion provider in Texas, also co-chair of the Committee to Protect Healthcare's Reproductive Freedom Task Force. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dr. Kumar, let's begin with you in Texas. Explain the Kate Cox case, the abnormality her fetus had, what it meant for her, and how it's possible the court went from saying, yes, you're one of the exceptions to this abortion ban, to having basically to flee the state of Texas so that she would not be, well, one of her great fears was sterile so that she couldn't have more children.
Case. It's devastating to hear what Kate Cox has had to experience. And unfortunately, it's one of hundreds, if not thousands, of comparable stories where people know what's best for them. They're consulting their medical team, making decisions. But unfortunately, in Texas, they're unable to exercise that right. From what I understand from public records, Kate Cox had a pregnancy that was diagnosed with trisomy 18, also referred to as Edwards syndrome, where it's extremely likely that the pregnancy would not continue to term. Even if the pregnancy did continue to term, survival is very, very low. In public records, Kate also mentioned that she would like to have future children and preserve her fertility. And so if this pregnancy were to continue, her health would be at stake and her future fertility would also be in limbo and unclear. And so the decision that she made with her medical team was to end this pregnancy. And I think we could clearly hear in her voice how difficult that decision might have been and how much emotion she's feeling. And she sought that care here close to home in her home state of Texas. And again, we see these stories all the time. This is a very common scenario. While Kate's story is personal and unique to her, this is very, very similar to what I hear from hundreds of people. And before the fall of Roe, I would be able to help these folks, even if they are in a difficult moment, to at least get through it, to be able to live their lives in their own terms, and to decide what's best for their future. In this case with Kate, it might have been to have children at some other time, and hopefully have a healthy pregnancy that she can carry to term. So luckily, Kate did have the ability to go out of state. That doesn't mean it's easy or, nice for folks to go out of state. They should be able to get the care here in Texas. Many people, unfortunately, aren't able to make it out of state. And in states like Texas and in Kentucky and in other states that have abortion bans, folks are being forced to carry those pregnancies to term, putting their lives at risk, their families' lives at risk. And it's a really unfortunate situation that we have here in Texas.
You see around the country when politicians vote in abortion bans, they always say, oh, there are exceptions. Now, there was an exception in Texas. Ultimately, the court ruled that she could have that procedure because of what was at stake for her. But then you have the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, who himself, they attempted to impeach, has been charged with corruption. And he blocked that. He sued and the court agreed. And talk about what it means that a physician like you or a hospital or a cab driver driving a pregnant person somewhere could be sued by anyone in this country if they were involved with them getting an abortion, sometimes to save their own lives.
Yep, this is exactly what we've been talking about for years now. We have a very hostile situation in Texas when it comes to reproductive rights, specifically abortion. And really anybody who's at risk of becoming pregnant or is pregnant is under this hostile regime that includes the Texas Attorney General. We have three abortion bans, one that was written in 1840s or 1850s, one that was passed after Roe fell, and then SB 8, which would allow anybody to bring a lawsuit forward without knowing the person who had the abortion up to 3 years after the abortion took place. So while these politicians say there are exceptions, somebody really has to be at death's door before we can reasonably act in their favor. And here we have a situation where somebody has a non-viable pregnancy, their physician has looked at their specifics of their medical history and determined that this is the best thing for them, sought some relief from the courts, a judge heard the case and said it's okay for this to move forward, and yet the Texas Attorney General is coming in with a letter threatening the physician, threatening anybody involved with that care, threatening all three hospitals where this physician has admitting privileges, and the consequences are loss of medical license, monetary fines, civil and criminal liability, as well as potentially life in jail. So this is not something that we take lightly. While physicians like me want to provide care, we have the skills and training to provide care for these folks, we're simply under a very oppressive regime that makes it unclear if we can act in our patients' best favor until they are sicker and closer to death, which is exactly what we as physicians want to avoid, while the state is pushing them further in that direction.
I want to bring Tamara Weider into the conversation, Kentucky State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. If you can update us on what is happening with Jane Doe. On Monday, attorneys informed a Kentucky court that after filing a class action lawsuit challenging the state's abortion ban last Friday, the lead plaintiff, who we know now as Jane Doe, learned her embryo no longer has cardiac activity. What's happening there in Kentucky?
Yes. So that is all that really is public knowledge at this point to protect Jane Doe's identity. That has been key to this lawsuit moving forward. But at this time, nothing really changes the trajectory of this lawsuit moving forward, which is that we are going to move forward with Jane Doe at this moment because it doesn't change why we brought the suit forward. She was pregnant in a state that did not allow her to terminate a pregnancy, which she wanted to terminate, and she was going to have to leave the state to seek her abortion. Just like over a million other people of reproductive age in Kentucky right now who find themselves pregnant and seeking an abortion, they have to leave the state. Or just like in Texas, if they have a medical emergency, they're taken right up to the line of near death to access those medical exemptions or so-called exemptions because there is so much liability right now that hospitals are afraid to take on in the Commonwealth. And so people are having to leave the state and go either to Illinois or right now Ohio. But there's lots of new legislation that, you know, we are hearing from that are going to make it more difficult or, you know, increase the chilling effect. And what's happening in Texas is definitely going to increase a chilling effect up here in Kentucky because these laws, restrictions, and these attacks don't happen in a vacuum. But we will move forward with our lawsuit currently with Planned Parenthood as a plaintiff as well.
Jane Doe said in a press statement, I am angry that now that I am pregnant and do not want to be, the government's interfering in my private matters and blocking me from having an abortion. I'm bringing this lawsuit because I firmly believe everyone should have the ability to make their own decisions about their pregnancies. So you have a number of other people that are being represented here. And if you can talk about the politics of Kentucky do you see this ban being lifted?
Sure. So we hope it is a class action lawsuit. So we do hope that people hearing about this case who may be in a similar situation in Kentucky who would like to join our class action lawsuit, they do have to be pregnant and seeking an abortion at the time that they join the class action lawsuit. Can call the ACLU of Kentucky or Planned Parenthood here in Kentucky, and we can talk with them and see if they can join the class action lawsuit. We have been looking since February when the Supreme Court of Kentucky informed us with our previous lawsuit that providers could not, take our case forward without a patient. And so we had to start over and find a plaintiff, which has taken us some time. So we are so incredibly proud and honored that Jane Doe stepped forward, especially, you know, in a politically hostile environment. I wouldn't say that Kentucky is necessarily hostile. We have now had two elections where abortion has really been cemented as a winning issue in Kentucky. We had a constitutional amendment last year that
And you actually have, as we wrap up, Democratic Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear is set for inauguration today. Many say his race turned on a referendum and abortion.
Correct. Yes. Andy Beshear's race really turned on abortion. Really moved people to vote on abortion access, where our Attorney General Daniel Cameron was one of the most restrictive attorney generals, similar to Ken Paxton on abortion, and people turned out against him on abortion.
We have to leave it there. Tamara Weider, Kentucky State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates, wearing a pin that says, bans off our bodies, and Dr. Bhavik Kumar, family medicine physician and abortion provider in Texas.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.